How to govern wisely.
Well, good morning, brothers and sisters, and my dear young people. We come to Proverbs 29, to the last chapter, to the last section of this part of Proverbs, which, of course, began in chapter 25, as Hezekiah began to copy out these principles from the words of Solomon that might help him in the matters of kingship, and in fact, as we've seen, that will help us all in the principles of kingship and preparation for kingship in the age to come. In Proverbs chapter 29, then, we've come really to what we believe is a chapter on the principles of, as we've expressed it, how to govern wisely. Having learned all the other things that the king has learned on how to handle specific issues, how to discern characters, how to manage relationships, how to show integrity in the principles of his own life, he now finally comes to the matter of government itself, to the management of the kingdom, to the actual exercising of that authority in the matters of daily life as he attends to the administration of his people. And so we believe that the key idea of Proverbs 29, as we've said then, is how to govern wisely. And the breakup of the chapter that I've got, at least in my Bible, is as follows. Verses 1 to 14, the need for wise administration. The need for wise administration. And God willing, those are the verses that we shall try and deal with this morning by way of closing thoughts and closing exhortation from this particular chapter. And then verses 15 to 21, the need for sound discipline. The need for sound discipline. And finally, in verses 22 to 27, the need for spiritual balance. There are so many things in life where one can go to one extreme or the other, and one needs the balance of the truth at all times to steer that right and proper course that wise kings do. The need for spiritual balance. Verses 22 to 27. So then, in Proverbs 29, in verse 1, we read this. It says, he that being often reproved hardeneth his neck shall suddenly be destroyed, and that without remedy. So, you see, this proverb comes first, right at the start of this section, on the need for wise administration, because you see, this particular proverb is a special danger for kings. You see, here is the stubborn refusal to repent in the face of either repeated warnings, or repeated pleas, or even repeated chastenings. Refusal to repent. This is a particular evil, you see, for kings to avoid, because, you see, the very position of the king, his position of authority, makes it possible for him to ignore all pleas, doesn't it? Even to remove the person who has presumed to criticize him. So this is a particular danger for kings as they begin their administration of their realm. It's the spirit of secret pride. It's the danger of digging our toes in. So that finally the mind is gradually stiffened against counsel and against advice until in the end it becomes unteachable, uncounselable. So you see, the Proverbs have a whole series of warnings about this particular virtue and how necessary it is. Again, we haven't got time to look them up. I'll just read two or three to you and give you the references. Proverbs 13 and verse 18 says, poverty and shame shall be to him that refuseth instruction, but he that regardeth reproof shall be honored. Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 5 says, a fool despiseth his father's instruction, but he that regardeth reproof is prudent. Chapter 15 and verse 10 says that correction is grievous unto him that forsaketh the way, and he that hateth reproof shall die. So how necessary it is, particularly for kings, that they learn this particular principle. In fact, you see what the verse says. It says that finally, sudden destruction comes through the build up of a problem to either breaking point or the exhaustion of God's patience himself. And so the proverb says, he that being often reproved hardens his neck shall suddenly be destroyed, and that without remedy. It seems to come so dramatically quickly, doesn't it? Of course, it's not sudden at all, really, is it? Verse 1. It's not really sudden. You see, this person's had plenty of warning. It says, he that being often reproved.
It's not as if this is the first time that he's been aware of the problem. It's only sudden to the person, you see. It's only sudden to the offender, because they have refused advice and counsel over a long period of time. And so the lesson of verse 1, the principle of verse 1, and what a good way to start counsel and advice on wise administration for a king. The lesson is that nobody is above correction, not even a ruler. And rulers particularly always need to preserve a sense of humility in the way that they administer their kingdom. How true that is in ecclesial life and in family life. And how important it is that wise administrators are there who understand those principles. Because you see what verse 2 says about how crucial this is. You see, verse 2 says, look, when the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when the wicked beareth rule, the people mourn. So you see, what we're being told here in the second verse is that the well-being of a whole community is bound up in the spirit of those who are in authority. The increase of the righteous leads to stability, to justice, to peace within the community. And the whole city or the whole nation or the whole ecclesia participates in that blessing. Whereas on the other hand, if the wicked rise, it spells tyranny and war and oppression and suffering. And it's always the people that suffer in the consequence, isn't it? The world is full of terrible examples of tyrannical and oppressive rulers where the wicked have borne rule and the people suffer and mourn as a consequence. So you see, what verse 2 is telling us is this, that those that are involved in wise administration must always remember this, that their own personal standards have an enormous effect on the lives of others. Be they righteous or wicked, it will have a tremendous effect, you see, on the lives of other people, what they're like. So therefore, we ought to learn to be righteous in our ways. How true this is in ecclesial life and family life. So how do the righteous, verse 2 then, how do the righteous seek to increase themselves so that there might always be stability in the kingdom? How do the righteous seek to ensure that their principles are carried through into the next generation so that the wicked never do bear rule, but only the righteous are in authority so that the people might rejoice and benefit? Well, verse 3, I think, says, you see, verse 3 says, whoso loveth wisdom rejoiceth his father, but he that keepeth company with harlots spendeth his substance. Now you see, we've had parables or proverbs about wise sons before. Chapter 10, verse 1, chapter 13, verse 1, chapter 15, verse 20, chapter 23, verse 24, chapter 28, verse 7. We've had a whole set of proverbs in this book of proverbs about wise sons. But everyone's a little different. Every proverb's just a little different. And you see what this particular proverb says. You see, it isn't just a wise son in verse 3, is it? It says, it's a wise son who loveth wisdom. So this is not just the son who's being dutifully obedient to his father because his father's asked him to. He loves wisdom for himself, does this son. This is the son's own genuine choice in life. This is the son's own code of standard for his behavior. He loves wisdom, not just because his father's told him to. Now, this truly rejoices his father, because what this means now is that the standard of righteousness for wise administration will move into the next generation, won't it? The flame has been passed. The next generation, just as our brother David has said, that Paul passed the flame on to Timothy. There's something interesting here. You notice that this verse says, he that loveth wisdom rejoices his father, but he that keepeth company with harlots spendeth his substance. By the way, the his although it's in italics, I think is there. Whose substance, by the way? His substance or his father's substance? Perhaps both, in a sense, isn't it? But ultimately, I think the father's substance is that which is spent by such profligate sons. Now, you notice if you compare Proverbs 29 and verse 3 with Proverbs 28 and verse 7, which we didn't have time to look at, but which says this, "Whoso keepeth the law is a wise son, but he that is a companion of riotous men shameth his father." It's quite similar, isn't it, that proverb? "He that is a companion of riotous men shameth his father." And here in this one, "He that keepeth company with harlots spendeth his substance." Now, remember, good Bible reading is the basis of good Bible study. Bible echoes. The Gospel of Luke has what's called the parables of the lost. Unique to the Gospel of Luke, are they not? The parables of the lost, the lost coin, the lost sheep, the lost son. If you come to the parable of the lost son, just for a moment, in Luke chapter 15, isn't it? Just a couple of interesting things there. Just, you see, I think those two proverbs became the foundation stone for the Lord's teaching on the prodigal son. Proverbs 28, verse 7, "He that keepeth the law is a wise son, but he that is a companion of riotous men shameth his father." And Proverbs 29, verse 3, "Whoso loveth wisdom rejoices his father, but he that keepeth company with harlots spendeth his substance." Now, you see Luke 15 and verse 11 for connection. Luke 15, 11, he said, "A certain man had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the portion of goods that falleth to me.' And he divided unto them his living. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together and took his journey into a far country. And there he wasted his substance with riotous living." That's interesting, isn't it? That's the very words from those proverbs, isn't it? Did you notice that? "He wasted his substance with riotous living." And again, notice verse 30, the words of the older son. "As soon as this thy son was come, which hath devoured thy living with harlots," he says. That's Proverbs 28. And Proverbs 29. You see, I think that those two proverbs were the basis for the Lord's parable. Remember how we said that we believe that every parable of the Lord is founded on a proverb? Well, here it is, you see. Here's the root of the parable in the proverbs here. Marvelous study that would be, wouldn't it? If only we had time to take the Lord's parables and trace them back into the book of Solomon's own wisdom, but we haven't got time. So we come back then to Proverbs 29 and verse 3. Let's just bring together the principle of the verse. So here is the son who spends his father's substance, as opposed to the son who loves wisdom. And you see, the two sons are so vastly different, aren't they? Because, you see, the one spends, not by the way, just his father's worldly wealth, but everything that the father stands for. He squanders his father's values. He sells his father's principles. He gives away the very substance of his father. Whereas a wise son, by way of contrast, is going to continue the standards of the family and thereby increase the father's substance, in a sense, because he loves wisdom and therefore rejoices his father. So you see, I think the lesson of verse 3 is this. Those that are in positions of responsibility and authority need to have the foresight to think ahead that they have inculcated right principles into their offspring so that there might be a continuity into the next generation. It's not good enough just to think about our own lives, but about the transfer of principles into the next generation. You know, it's often been my personal conviction that the greatest thing that we can do in the truth is to light the flame of the truth in the next generation. If only we can do that, then the truth will continue. That's the greatest challenge facing all of us. Wise rulers understand that. This is, in fact, the very thing that Brother David said, isn't it? They spend time with the next generation to ensure that those principles have been inculcated so that the righteous might continue to increase and the ecclesia rejoice thereby. Verse 4 of Proverbs 29 says, "The king by judgment establisheth the land, but he that receiveth gifts overthroweth it." Now, the word judgment here is actually not the normal word for judgment. The normal Hebrew word for judgment is shafat, to judge. This is the word mishpat, which really means justice rather than judgment. It's not talking so much about the act of judgment or the execution of judgment as the upholding of just principles. So the NIV says, by justice, a king gives a country great stability. And you see, it requires integrity and courage for those involved in administration to avoid self-interest, that justice might be upheld and that the land might be governed with wisdom. It's important that rulers have that integrity to do that. On the other hand, says the verse, he that receives gifts overthroweth the land. Actually, the word gift here is an interesting one. We've just looked in the book of Timothy at the principles of sin and trespass offerings, and I think at drink offerings, didn't we, in that last session? Well, interestingly enough, the word gift here in the Hebrew is the word teruma. Now, does anyone know what teruma is? What offering is that? Anybody know? Well, it's the word used in the Old Testament consistently for the heave offering. The very word used here for the word gift. So what could be surely wrong with a little present? A little heave offering for the ruler. What's wrong with that? Surely nothing. But you see, the problem is that this little gift in verse 4 is not an innocent present, is it? It's given in order, in fact it's not only given, it's both given and received, in order to pervert the cause of justice. So therefore you'll notice that a number of other translations say it's not a gift at all, it's actually talking about a man who's open to receiving bribes. That's the sort of gift that's being dealt with here. Now, just come back to Deuteronomy for a moment, into the 16th chapter. I think we made reference to this the other day, but we didn't turn it up. We shall now, just for a moment, Deuteronomy 16. And you see how expressly the law legislated against this principle. You can't have wise administration if you compromise yourself in this way. Now, you see, in Deuteronomy 16, the law was very clear. Verse 18, judges and officers shalt thou make thee in all thy gates, which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Throughout thy tribes they shall judge the people with just judgment. Now, here's the law. Verse 19, thou shalt not wrest judgment, thou shalt not respect persons, neither take a gift. Why not? Because a gift doth blind the eyes of the wise and pervert the words of the righteous. That which is altogether just shalt thou follow. So we're not to receive these gifts because they're going to compromise our integrity, and wise rulers will not accept anything that might cloud their judgment or compromise the truth for private ends. Wise administration of the kingdom can never be achieved when partiality is shown. Of course, you see, it's one of these things where we have to say, well, how does this actually work? Because there aren't actually all that many presents given out in the ecclesia. Leastways, I can't remember receiving many gifts. So how does it work? Well, you see, the gift could be more than one thing, couldn't it? You see, the gift could be recognition, couldn't it? The gift could be applause. The gift could be admiration. The gift could be prominence. The gift could be favor. Oh, yes, there's quite a few gifts that we might be somewhat inclined towards receiving. Well, the lesson of the proverb is, no, you ought not to do that if it's going to compromise the wise administration of the kingdom. So remember that when we talk about the wise administration of the kingdom could be the ecclesia, couldn't it? It could be our home, our family, whatever the kingdom is that we're involved in. Now, here is a particular gift that would be most unwise for a king to receive, and that's verse 5. One of the worst gifts of all that will pervert the cause of justice, a man that flattereth his neighbor, spreadeth a net for his feet. So yes, this would be a gift very unwise to receive, because you see, flattery is normally given for an express... You see, most flattery is not given innocently, is it? Most people don't flatter just for the sake of flattery. You see, flattery always has an objective behind it, doesn't it? And the objective of flattery usually is to allure the person into some devious path, some path away from the truth. And the great danger of flattery lies in that it ruinously inflates our self-esteem. It entangles the victim by inducing a craving for this sort of thing, you see. Funny thing about the weakness of the flesh, isn't it? That, you see, even when a flatterer comes to us and flatters us with words that we know really to be absolutely wrong, we sort of, you know, like it, really. If someone comes to us and says flattering things that are absolutely wrong, are we filled with indignation at that person? Well, you see, it happens even in ecclesial life. I've seen this happen. Look, there's a bit of a problem here. Now, we think this should be done, and we felt that what should be done is so and so. We really should take this to the arranging minister. Now, brother, you'd be an excellent choice to do this little thing. Why don't you go and say to the arranging minister? Do not accept the gift. You're being led down a path that has nothing to do with wise administration. It will pervert the cause of wise administration. Resist the danger of these sorts of gifts. Verse 6 says, in the transgression of an evil man there is a snare, but the righteous doth sing and rejoice. Now, by the way, you see in verse 5, you see whose feet are caught in the net? And the answer is not the flatterer, but the person that is being flattered. But you see, in verse 6, the snare, in fact, doesn't catch the one that the evil man is speaking to. It's the evil man himself that's caught by his own transgressions, isn't it? And so Moffat says, a bad man is snared by his own sin. Now you see, this is what sin is like. You see, sin has a nasty habit of entangling and entrapping us, doesn't it? Sin entangles and entraps us into situations where principles of wise administration get lost. So it's not a good thing. Whereas, says the verse, the righteous doth sing and rejoice. Now, some translations, where it says the righteous doth sing and rejoice, they have a different pointing of the... They have a different consonant in the manuscripts, in some manuscripts, so that instead of yarus, one has yarun, and it changes it from instead of the righteous doth sing and rejoice, it ought to be translated the righteous doth run and rejoice. And I actually think that's a valid translation, and I'll tell you why. Because you see, the contrast is that the evil man is trapped in his own snare. It snaps him by the feet, and he's not free. He's entangled by his own sin. He can't govern wisely. But the righteous are free. They're free to run. They're untrammeled by sin. Sin doesn't complicate their lives. They're free to govern in the best interests of the truth. And they rejoice in that freedom to do so. So wise rulers need to keep free from those entrapments of sin in life that will affect their ability to rule wisely. And how important that wise administration is, because you see what verse 7 says, the righteous considereth the cause of the poor, but the wicked regardeth not to know it. See, really hard thing when you're a king and you've got everything that the heart could wish or desire for, to sort of think about the poor, the underprivileged. It's a difficult thing at times for a king to enter into the spirit of those that are lacking or deprived in his kingdom. Now you see, the book of Proverbs commends care for the poor. Chapter 14, verse 31, chapter 21, verse 13. It's commended in the book of Proverbs that we show care for the poor. Now, righteous rulers do that, says this verse, but the wicked regardeth not to know it. So you see, righteous rulers have a concern for, well, you see what it says, they don't just have a concern for the poor, but for the cause of the poor, which is what the law taught. Leviticus 19 verse 15 taught just that same principle. Whereas the wicked have no such concern for the rights or cause or needs of the poor at all. So what do righteous rulers do? Well, they investigate the claims of the poor, and they take care that those claims are not lost through the inability of the poor to defend themselves or to explain themselves. You know, there's a marvelous proverb chapter 18, verse 23, that says, "The poor useth entreaties, but the rich speaketh roughly." I think that's right. Let me just check that in case I've misquoted. Does that sound about right? Chapter 18 and verse 23. I just have this sudden dreadful feeling that I've misquoted scripture. It's not too bad. "The poor useth entreaties, but the rich answereth roughly." Why do the poor use entreaties? Because they're always at the bottom of the pile, aren't they? They've always got to say, "Please, please don't, please help." They've always got to entreat, they've always got to supplicate. The rich don't have to be like that. The rich can afford to be rough. You know why? Because they can afford to be like that. Now you see, the great test of those who give wise administration is the fact that they are prepared to consider the poor, those who are unable to represent their own interests, those that are unable to explain sometimes their difficulties. The word poor here, by the way, isn't just physical poverty, but social poverty. Sometimes it's the quiet person in the ecclesia, the shy person, the diffident person, the timid person. Aren't these all poor, in a sense? How easy it is to overlook them, to not hear them. Wise rulers learn to show impartial care and consideration for the needs of all in the kingdom. And what a contrast that is to the spirit of verse 8, isn't it? Because look how different these people are compared to the wise rulers that we have been asked to be. Verse 8 says, "Scornful men bring a city into a snare, but wise men to..." By the way, you see this word wise, you see how that is a key word here. Verse 3, wisdom. Verse 8, wise. Verse 9, wise. Verse 11, wise. You see, that's why we've entitled this section the need for wise administration. It's the outworking of wisdom in the matters of governance. So verse 8 says that scornful men bring a city into a snare. Now, if righteous rulers in verse 7 take care for the needs of all, then what are the scornful like in verse 8? And the answer is, well, these are the people who couldn't care less. These are the people who have that arrogant spirit of pride which makes them absolutely indifferent to the feelings or the needs of others. They don't really mind. They don't really care what other people think. They're only worried about prosecuting their own cause. Now, you see the word snare here in verse 8. It's not the same as the word snare in verse 6, is it? It was a trap in verse 6, a trap that entangles the sinner in his own problems. But in verse 8, the word snare here means something quite different. Jerusalem Bible says they set cities in a ferment. Moffat says they kindle strife. RSV says they set a city aflame. And you see, there are people like this even in ecclesial life. They get all worked up about a problem, and they say, "Well, I'm going to do something about that." "Well, don't you think you should?" No, I'm really upset about this. I'm going to take this to the arranging bit. We're going to have this out if necessary. And I'll get 10 signatures and we'll call a special meeting of the ecclesia if necessary so that I can get this matter through. And they light the fuse and they throw it into the ecclesia and up she goes. And before you know it, the whole ecclesia's in an uproar. Because you see, these sorts of people, they couldn't care less about the controversy they create. They're quite happy to plunge others into the trouble without regard for the consequences. Now, here's the principle of the verse. And I think it's a very important principle. The scornful ignite. Wise rulers defuse. They learn to do that, you see. There are always those who, not content to raise their feelings in a quiet spirit of brotherly love, they want to involve as many people as possible in the controversies they create. And those involved in wise administration inevitably are found moving around the ecclesia, putting the fires out. Because what's been going on, what's been happening, is not in the best interest of the truth, doesn't honour Yahweh at all. So wise people learn to diffuse these sorts of fiery conflagrations in ecclesial life. Now, you see, I don't want you to get me wrong here. I'm not suggesting that the wise ignore the problem. If there's a problem, then it needs to be dealt with. This is not suggesting that wise rulers ignore the problem. What it is saying is that the way the problem is handled will determine its outcome. And if one really wants to handle issues in a way so that the truth is advanced, then we will learn to find the right approach in order that we might seek the right outcome. Verse 9, of course, says that, you know, sometimes it doesn't matter what you do, you're not going to get anywhere anyway, because verse 9 says, you see, if a wise man contend with a foolish man, whether he rage or laugh, there is no rest. Now, you see, this time, the word contend here is the word shafat, the normal Hebrew word for judge. So now we've got a sort of judicial contest between the wise man and the foolish man here. Now, what we're being told in this verse is that the fool will neither listen to reason, nor will he yield to arguments. He will either rage with fury, or he will laugh you to scorn. But you see, what the verse is saying is that either way, it's impossible to reason with him, it's impossible to resolve the dispute calmly, and it's impossible to reach agreement. There are people like this in ecclesial life, aren't there? It doesn't matter what you do, you've lost before you begin. They'll either foam at the mouth in rage, or they'll laugh their head off. But either way, says the proverb, the one thing you never get is any rest. There's no rest in the matter, no conclusion, no peace, no shalom. So what do you think the lesson of verse 9 is? It's interesting, actually, because you see the proverb is sort of almost left unanswered. It's almost left open, isn't it? It doesn't say what you should do. And I think you see that the lesson is that the circumstances in the end will decide, therefore, what you shall do. And I think there's only two things you can do with these sorts of people. There's only two things you can do. I think the one decision on some occasions is you've got to look at how important the matter is. Is this crucial to the truth and to the interests of the truth? All right, well, if it's not, then walk away, because you're never going to win. So leave it be. It's a matter of, it's not a fundamental thing. Then leave it be. Do not enter into controversy with those whom you know you can never help and never accomplish agreement with. You can never reach resolution with some people. Walk away. Leave it be. Wise rulers learn that sometimes there are some problems that you just cannot solve. And I think the other thing is, depending on how important the issue is that there are times in ecclesial life, and I've seen this happen, where there's been a problem in the meeting and someone's been all wound up to 99 about this particular subject, and they come in and they proclaim their views to the arranging brethren, and they go on and on and on about it, and in the end there comes a time when you've got to say, well, look, brother, we've heard what you've said. We thank you for your thoughts. We have heard them. But we've decided that we're going to do this anyway, or that anyway, and we've given it long consideration. We believe that this is in the best interest of the truth, and we've made the decision to do that. And here endeth the matter. It's over. It's closed. I'm sorry. And sometimes arranging brethren need to do that in ecclesial life so that controversy doesn't run along endlessly, because these people will always do that if they can. So the proverb doesn't say which line to take. I think the circumstances will tell us at the time. Remember this, that this is the key. Every circumstance, every problem, the first thing we should say is, what will best advance the cause of the truth here? I'll take that line. We'll take that approach. Now, verse 10 says that wise administrators, wise rulers, have to learn that in the discharge of their responsibilities, they'll have those that do come into hostility with them, opposition with them. In fact, verse 10 says, the bloodthirsty hate the upright, but the just seek his soul. You see, this is a state of enmity between the thinking of the spirit and the thinking of the flesh that began all the way back in Genesis chapter 3, wasn't it? That bloodthirsty state of hostility between the two seeds. This is Cain and Abel. Remember that passage in the first of John? that Cain slew Abel, and wherefore slew he him, says the apostle, because his own works were evil and his brothers were righteous. And you see, there's been something from time immemorial, in fact from the days of the Garden of Eden, from the time of those two boys, where there's something about personal purity and personal integrity in a person's life that excites the enmity of the flesh. It's always been so. By the way, deep down, I think they respect you. They respect that principle, but they sort of manifest a hostility to it. The flesh doesn't like the purity of the truth. John, everyone that doeth evil hateth the light. Now, by the way, you see the second part of the verse where it says, but the just seek his soul. That the word seek there is really a Hebrew word that's invariably used in a hostile sense. It doesn't mean that they seek his soul to uphold it. It means they seek his soul to take it away. Remember the cry of Elijah? I have been very jealous for the Lord God of Israel. And I only am left. And they seek my life to take it. So when it says that they seek his soul, they don't seek his soul to preserve it, they seek to take it. The revised version says, as for the upright, they seek his life. The NIV says they seek to kill the upright. So the spirit of the verse, I think, is this, that those who are endeavoring to maintain principles of wise administration, being blameless in their lives, will from time to time find that they are singled out for unreasonable criticism and for unwarranted hostility. And the exhortation of this verse is a plea that we ought to remain upright to those divine principles, irrespective of whatever hostility may come our way. That's part of the responsibilities of wise administration, not to deviate from the path of truth. Even when at times there are those that seek our soul, that's the manifestation of the flesh, isn't it? And we're trying to manifest instead here divine principles. And here's another divine principle, because you see what verse 11 says, a fool uttereth all his mind, but a wise man keepeth it until afterwards. I've always felt, you know, that in the authorized version, this particular verse is perhaps just a tad misleading. It sort of implies, doesn't it, that a fool sort of has all his anger and fury and rage, and he blurts it all out at the start, but a wise man keeps it all in until... And then afterwards it comes bursting forth later on in the wise man. Now that's not what the proverb means at all, is it, really? What it's saying, first of all, is that a fool gives... You see, fools lack self-control, don't they? You know, there's another marvellous proverb that you might take as a cross-reference, which is chapter 15, verse 2, that says, the tongue of the wise useth knowledge aright, but the mouth of fools poureth out foolishness. The mouth of fools poureth out foolishness. You see, they can't control themselves. They blurt it all out, their anger, their wrath, their feelings, their rage. The Jerusalem Bible says, the fool comes out with all his angry feelings. So if that's what the fool does, then that's clearly not what the wise man does. So what does the wise man do when in verse 11 it says that he keeps it in till afterwards? Well, the Jerusalem Bible says, the wise man subdues and restrains them. Greens says, but the wise holding back quiets it. So you see, the proverb does not teach that the wise man holds back his feelings only to lash out later on. What it teaches is that in holding back his feelings, he brings them under control and pacifies them. This is not anger merely checked for the moment, but in fact overcome. That's what wise rulers learn to do. They overcome their anger. In Psalm 89 and verse 9, it says that when the waves of the sea arise, thou stillest them. And the word stillest in Psalm 89 and verse 9 is the same Hebrew word used here, that he keeps it in. He settles his feeling. You know, aren't there times in ecclesial life and family life where, you know, something happens and, ooh, you can just feel those feelings rising up, can't you? You ever had that situation in life? In most situations, I regard myself as a thoroughly reasonable man. Actually, there's only one thing, though, that I get... Well, no, that's not true. I was going to say, there's one thing that actually really upsets me in life more than anything else. You know what it is?
The funny thing, I think it's something to do with my childhood experiences or something, I'm not sure, but there's one thing that really makes me mad, in a controlled sense, of course, and that's injustice. I hate injustice. I hate seeing something that is just absolutely unjust and unfair when you know it is. That's a particular problem I've got. You see, there are times when I can really feel the feelings coming up, and this proverb says, well, wise administrators learn not to blurt it all out, do they? They keep it in check and they actually overcome it. You see, the lesson of the verse is that those that rule are often subject to extreme provocation of spirit, but they must learn to master their emotions. Rulers must first learn to rule themselves. What a great truth that is. True for all of us. You know what they say, if you're angry, count to 10. And if you're very angry, count to 100. Because otherwise, you're responding according to the thinking of the flesh, aren't you? Verse 12, if a ruler hearkens to lies, all his servants are wicked. You see, in biblical times, rulers were open to the counsel of their ministers, but they were also open to the needs of their people. Remember the days of Moses, where the people would come to Moses and make their requests known to him? Remember that? And there'd be this endless circle of people coming to the tent of Moses that he might hear their requests and give counsel. Imagine the demands of a king. Imagine the demands on a king as the people of the realm come to make their petitions to the king. And you see, in the course of all that, a ruler hears many things, doesn't he? A ruler hears many tales, and some of the tales that he hears are lies. But that's not what this proverb says. The proverb doesn't caution, the proverb doesn't say that a ruler oughtn't to hear lies. He will. The proverb cautions against hearkening to lies. That's quite a different thing, isn't it? You see, this is about the ruler who's too ready to listen to lies, too ready to take up the fact that they are truth when they're not, too ready to listen to those things that are evil. A love of gossip and scandal. Now, you see, the ruler who's too ready to do that will breed envy and prejudice and scandal in his own court. And worse still, the upright will leave him. One by one, the upright will quietly slip away from the ruler, from his entourage, from the royal household. They will slip away because the ruler is hearkening to lies. And you see, the real tragedy is not just that the ruler does it, but you see what happens. You see, it says all his servants are wicked. You see the word servants here? It's not the normal word for servants. It's not the normal household slave here. It's a special word, sharaf, which is actually normally translated ministers. And so the Revised Standard Version, for example, says all his officials become wicked. Jerusalem Bible says, I quite like this, Jerusalem Bible says all his ministers become scoundrels. Now you see, these are the men who administer the king's laws. And what this proverb says is that if the king listens to lies, they will follow suit. And in the end, the whole kingdom will be affected. So the exhortation is to realize how much, again, a personal stand for truth has as an influence on others. Rulers have a greater responsibility in setting examples in this regard, that they do not listen to scandal. They want to hear truth. They do not allow lies to multiply, either in the family or in the ecclesial house. Verse 13 says, the poor and the deceitful meet together, the Lord lighteneth both their eyes. Now, here's an interesting set of proverbs for you. We're pretty well short of time because we've just run out of time now, but I'm just going to chase you through two or three quick references. Firstly, chapter 22 and verse 2. Just three references here. Proverbs 22 verse 2 says, the rich and poor meet together. Yahweh is the maker of them all. So what Proverbs 22 and verse 2 tells us is that we all have a common origin. God is the maker of us all. Rich and poor met together in the origination of the creative power from God. Now come and have a look at Job chapter 3 and verse 19. Now you see, whilst Proverbs 22 verse 2 speaks of a common origin, Job chapter 3 and verse 19 says, well, now, what's he talking about? He's talking about the grave, actually. Verse 18, there the prisoners rest together. They hear not the voice of the oppressor. And then verse 19 says, the small and great are there, and the servant is free from his master. So you see, all meet together, not only in a common origin, says Proverbs 22, verse 2, but all have a common destiny, don't they? Rich and poor meet together in the grave. We all have a common destiny, you see. In Matthew chapter 5 and verse 45, another verse, and then we'll come back to our proverb. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 45 says, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven, for he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. So you see, Matthew 5 and verse 45 tells us that we also have a common reception of God-given blessings during our life, don't we? We all get the sun and the rain, the benefits of the Father, in common. Evil and good, just and unjust. Now, let's come back to our proverb then, Proverbs 29 and verse 13, and you see what the proverb says. It says that the poor and the deceitful meet together, the Lord lighteneth both their eyes. So here now, what we're being told in this particular proverb is that we also have a common status before the Father with regard to learning or receiving the truth. God lightens both their eyes. Irrespective of from what end of the pole of life they've come from, the Lord lighteneth both their eyes. Both the poor and the deceitful man may be the subject of divine enlightenment by his sovereign will. So here then is a lesson for wise rulers. And the lesson is this, that the wise ruler does not discriminate in the exercise of divine principles between persons. Shall I say that again? The wise ruler does not discriminate in his exercise of divine principles. We don't put difference between brethren. We treat all alike. The Lord does. So if God doesn't discriminate between people, why should we? We are the same towards all. We do not discriminate in any way with regard to the matters of wise administration. What a good and wholesome standard that is. And verse 14 finally says then, the king that faithfully judgeth the poor, his throne shall be established forever. So not only should we not discriminate between the rich or the poor, perhaps if anything we should show more concern for those who are in need. You see, I think what verse 14 is saying is that the test of a king in power, this is how one writer put it, and I thought this was good. He said, the test of a king in power is the extent to which he keeps faith with those who can put least pressure on him. That's a good principle, isn't it? Especially once he's risen to power. How well does he keep faith with, does he care for, does he worry about those who can actually put the least pressure on him, the poor, of no consequence? That's the measure of his faithfulness and the measure of his wisdom as a wise ruler given to wise administration. The king that learns to do that, his throne shall be established forever, says the proverb. This spirit, this principle is eternally beneficial, is the lesson of the proverb. How needful, brothers and sisters, that we learn those lessons of wise administration in our ecclesias, in our families, in our marriages, that the kingdom of God, even in this present age and prospect, can be governed wisely and for the good of the truth. And in all these things, of course, in all these principles for kingship, we realize that all we're really doing is manifesting the spirit of our Heavenly Father, aren't we? It's Him. It's God in these principles that we seek to reveal in our lives. The Lord is King. Lift up thy voice, O earth, and all ye heavens rejoice. From world to world the joy shall ring. The Lord omnipotent is King. The Lord is King. Who then shall dare resist his will, distrust his care, or murmur at his wise decrees, or doubt his royal promises? The Lord is King, child of the dust, the judge of all the earth is just. Holy and true are all his ways. Let every creature speak his praise. all wise, all perfect is the Lord. In every deed, in every word, let heaven and earth their tribute bring to praise and magnify their King.